Incoming transmission.
Welcome back across all space and time to the center of the universe in our quadrant called the Captain's Quadrant. I am your co-host, Joe Dove, and your host this week, as always, my main dude that's actually a lot taller than I am, Jason Roy Gaston.
Way taller.
The measuring is like ridiculous. When you meet us in Trek Long Island, folks, you're going to be amazed at how short Captain Joe Dove is. We are very excited to have the amazing author of the Star Trek, the animated series, official guide. He is a comic book author. He is a comic book drawer. He is an amazing
illustrator.
He's what? Illustrator.
Illustrator.
Illustrator, yes. Thank you. He is an amazing person. We've been friends for quite a bit. And he's also freaked me out because he illustrated a lot of the comic covers that I own. And I was like, oh, that's you? Oh, my God. So please welcome everybody in the Captain's Quadrant, Aaron Geekfilter. And like I said, no AA bond. So good to see you, sir. Welcome to the
Captain's Quadrant. And one time you actually thought that Geekfilter and Aaron Harvey were two separate people.
that sounds like I also thought that you and Aaron Sugar were the same person, so I'll get out of the way. So yeah,
lots all the confusion
Joe's done. Yeah. What started you in illustration? When did you start drawing? And what did you go to school for?
When I was a little kid, grew up with a congenital heart defect, so I was not like going outside a lot. So I took up drawing just because it was something I could do by myself. And also growing up, my grandfather worked for Lockheed. So he had plain drawings and schematics and all that kind of stuff everywhere. So I kind of was, I think that in the back of my head was probably always some sort of concept art or something was, you know, hanging on the wall. So yeah. I'm sure it was sort of like sunk into my brain. I actually have a book I still carry around that has all the different logos from like 1969 for the myriad of airlines. So I've always used that as sort of like a jumping off point if I'm really stuck on a logo. It's like, okay, what can I pull from this?
Wow.
So that's how I started. And I was self-taught. I did not end up going to any kind of art school.
Oh, neat. Yeah. That's like,
especially when we got into computer graphics and stuff, there wasn't really anywhere to go at that point because it was all brand new.
Oh, that's wild. So there's no like, no teacher going, Aaron, I told you, draw the line this way.
But I went to a digital art class in my junior college, and basically we had somebody come and try to recruit us. Mm-hmm. They showed us their video, and their video is of like this snowman in a snow globe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Pixar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that until much later. I'm like, wait, huh? Yeah, I turned that down because I was too young to like know where I wanted to live, and it was like and having a heart condition, I was sort of like limited in what I was able to do as well, so I did not move to San Francisco. But now I kind of wondered what my life would be like if I had done that.
Maybe you would just be here a lot earlier.
Maybe
right on the Captain's Quadrant,
or not at all, who knows.
We're that good.
So how did you get professionally started? What was your big break?
I think professionally, like in Star Trek,
In anything, in any illustrated capacity.
Probably the company that I worked with in 1999, Zentropy Partners, which was one of those .coms, you know, and I got to work on General Motors and Reebok and like, you know, all these Fortune 500 companies, which is funny because nobody knew what they were doing at the time. So we're all just kind of making it up a lot to go along, but we're having $1 million accounts that we have to be responsible for. So I did the first ad banner that had one object go from the banner to another object on the page. And it was for General Motors, and it was some sort of campaign they had with Viewmaster. So you like go through and you'd see like the different cars. Yeah, yeah. And they actually did they had the promotional Viewmaster you could get and all that. But I made it go from the Viewmaster, spin out, like show some cars, and then go up into the top banner. So you kind of follow the story. So that was kind of my, I think, just professionally in getting any kind of notice was probably that. But I've always been like, I entered drawing contests and stuff like that. That was a big thing. And I covered Tron Legacy in 2018. Oh. Yeah. So that, as far as, like, Neville Page and a bunch of other, like, just artists and designers. So that I think really helped me focus on what I could do professionally. But I do remember the Starlog magazine back in 1978, maybe. It was before the motion picture. They had a story on Ralph McQuarrie. And if you remember the early concepts of the Enterprise for the movie that never was made, it kind of looks like Discovery. That was this article. I had that in there. And I think it was when I was 8 years old. But I realized, oh, you can make a living doing this. This is an actual job. I didn't know drawing was a job.
Yes.
Yeah. I think Star Trek, in that sense, it always was also the thing that got me interested in doing that.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that episode of that issue of Starlog, because I was actually in the hospital whenever I was 12, and I was given that issue of Starlog to read. Wow. So I read all about the Ralph McQuarrie Enterprise and Planet of the Titans and In Thy Image and everything. So that is so cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, wow. That's why whenever it's like, oh, it's a phase two ship, I'm like, no, it's not phase two. Nobody cared but me.
So you grew up immersing yourself in Star Trek? Or you?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, I was a Star Wars fan. To start off, I mean, I like Star Trek. It was one of those things that, like, I watched. He's leaving. But my grandfather and my grandmother, either they didn't know what they were doing or they did know what they were doing, only gave me Star Trek stuff. So I'd ask for Star Wars something, I get Star Trek, and it's just like, okay, the universe is telling me something.
Yeah,
but Star Wars didn't have really cool technical manuals and stuff like that when it first came out. So
because most of the shit goes boom. So
yeah. Yeah, so I enjoyed
it's I think there's like on one. By an 8 foot tall Wookiee. How hard is it?
Well, also the Gorn. How the hell did the Gorn make ships?
especially
these ones now.
They fill that in the third.
But yeah,
they laid their eggs in other ships, obviously.
That's what that whole scene was about.
Yeah.
So then I just, you know, that kind of put me on that path, and I went to conventions when I could. I met Nichelle Nichols at a furniture store, which was very Galaxy Quest. You know, it was like right before Star Trek 4. And
never give up, never surrender.
Yeah, my reaction was like, why is she at a, you know, signing things at a furniture store? And somebody had to explain to me, it's like, yeah, they don't make the money that you think they do because they're on TV. It's like they have bills to pay and all that. So that was actually a really good lesson to hear that early on, honestly. Hmm. But
so it lowered your expectations. Is that what you're telling me?
Who's the other one that I met? Early on was I can't remember who now. Oh, Marina Sirtis.
Oh,
it was on that set of conventions that they told her, hey, you want to stay on the show? Maybe you should like start showing yourself more and like, you know, you're one of two women. And it's like, you know, get yourself out there. So that's when she was doing that. She came to Portland, Oregon, where I was. And so that was fun. She walked out and she's like, I know what you're asking. Where are they? Like the space boobs. Oh. So she's like, they are not with me today. And she's like, now those things that you wouldn't say just because of the internet.
Yeah. Things are very different now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So early on, you know, I met a lot of the people just at conventions and stuff. And Star Trek people are, you know, famously approachable and polite and, you know,
yeah.
So,
and they're willing to do podcasts. Thanks, Aaron.
I still think of myself as a Star Trek person yet, but yeah,
you should. You did a lot, man. And we're gonna get into a lot of that too. So,
yeah. So that's sort of went on a little long, but that was the background.
Yeah, who got you into the Star Trek business? Like, who pulled you into that universe?
Actual business? That would be John Van Sitters.
Oh, nice. And
I noticed on StarTrek.com, or not StarTrek.com, CBS All Access at the time, that their big panorama for the animated series had Lieutenant Uhura in green, like as she was like an Orion, and Chekhov, who was not in the show. It was like somebody's fan art that they put, you know, I was like, your show Discovery is going to come out soon. And I posted like basically like, maybe you guys should fix this. And I get this DM from him. It's like, could you take that down? And then I'll talk to you about like actually doing it. Cause I think at that point they were getting some flack from about Discovery because the Klingons had leaked and all that. So, but yeah, so I the first thing I did was update that graphic behind them, behind the text and everything on CBS All Access.
And then that's when you started making the big bucks, right? That was your biggest
check. Yeah, no. But no. We did pitch, yeah, the book was, I think that's really where, you know, I started solidifying that connection between everybody. I had a podcast called Saturday Morning Trek, and my friend Rich Sheppis and I were doing stuff at Trek Movie. And we were like, you know, we've got all this information. It's like, why don't we make a book? Because it honestly, the first time I started covering TAS was because no one else was. It was literally like the thing that was left over, you know, kind of. But then I got really into it. And I draw and I'm an illustrator, so it kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the fact that everybody who worked on TAS was like in their 20s, or most people. So those people are still, well, they were around at the time. So. Mm-hmm. And Bob Klein, who did like 80% of the ships and the people and all that stuff, he's still around. And, you know, we message back and forth. I show him my stuff if I'm doing something TAS related to, you know, get his seal of approval, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah. So we approached them with this book and we gave them the proposal. And I had mocked up like a cover, a two-page kind of facing thing. And maybe an index, I can't remember exactly, but wanted to give them an idea of the flavor of what the book would kind of be like. And so we wrote that, you know, a sample chapter and all that and sent it off. And apparently people don't do that. They like send a almost a hand-drawn letter that's just to say, I want to make a book. No. But apparently we did way more than anybody else did. So they were just instantly like, oh, wow, that's great. So, you know, John said, we'd like to pitch it. But, you know, please bear in mind that, you know, it could take a month. They have to find a publisher because the CBS doesn't publish on its own. Right. So, you know, we can pitch it to the publishers we know, but it could take a month. It could take a year. It might never happen. So it was sort of one of those, like, don't call us, we'll call you. Mm. So we just sort of put it aside. I set an alarm or a reminder in my calendar to, like, that was October. So, like, in January, just check in. And about 2 weeks later, they're like, hi, this never happens. I'm like, what? It's like, your book sold.
Nice.
We're ready to, I'm like, what? So apparently Inside Editions came to them and said, hey, do you have an animation book about Star Trek? And they're just like, yeah, now we do. So,
wow.
It was because when people ask me, oh, walk me through the process of getting a book made. I'm like, what I did will never happen to anybody else, or very rare. It was just sort of, it was a lot of, you know, stumbling into things, which was kind of crazy. So I definitely don't think it's like the average way to go about it. But so that was all, that's a fun story though, just because it's just so crazy that, you know, a week later, they're like, yep, ready. Our publisher, who was halfway through Inside Editions, got sold. And so we lost all of our people and new people came in. So that was fun. But the original art director, who was really cool, he's like, you know, congratulations, you're writing a book. And condolences, you're writing a book. So that is the process, is like, it's much more than you think it would be.
Yeah.
So in all of your research and looking into the dark corners of Star Trek, the animated series, tell us some of the strangest things that you discovered.
This is strange in the sense that it's been propagated to something else all this time, that pink was all the colors that were crazy because Hal Sutherland, you know, was colorblind and he didn't know how to pick the colors. And when I talked to Bob, because I said, you know, I have to ask you this, as somebody who has worked with creative teams, and, you know, I could see 1973 colorblind, fine, not picking them, but those colors remained through He-Man into the 80s. Like they were, and it was like, I cannot believe that it was accidental at that point, that someone didn't tell, like, either he's a tyrant and nobody wanted to approach him, or, you know, something's going on. He's like, Hal doesn't pick the colors. I'm like, what? It's like, yeah, no, we had, it was very regimented. Like they had a colorist. So basically he went in, he took the stuff, went into, closed his door, did whatever he wanted. Apparently he was not the happiest man in the world. So he just sort of picked whatever he wanted and didn't want to hear about it. So he was known as the pink and green guy. So yeah, it wasn't anything to do with colorblindness. Hal was colorblind slightly, but it's not, that didn't affect the show in any way. So
go ahead. Sorry. I'm colorblind and I can tell the colors that he chose suck.
I almost wonder if it's just like, hey, if I pick these, maybe they'll fire me or something like that. Oh, I just want to get out of this job. I don't know. The other funny thing is that they would stand on the corner of the building and watch car accidents because it was like one of the most dangerous corner in Los Angeles. Wow. They knew like some within a half hour of them standing there was going to be an accident. I don't live that far from here now. And like, yeah, it's still bad.
Yeah. Do you not drive then, or are you?
No, I drive.
So then you transitioned and you did comic books.
I actually was doing those at the same time. I think the first comic book I did before the book. So I guess that technically would be like, yeah, this.
Yeah.
I posted a lot of Discovery fan art, and I think that's what IDW came to me. It's like, hey, do you want to do a cover? I'm like, that's cool. Sure. Didn't know anything about how to do it at all. So like that was the other thing. And one of the reasons they wanted my artwork style is that it wasn't like a comic book. It was more, you know, poster like, or, and you know, artsy. So I ended up doing a crossover, a Star Trek Green Lantern crossover with the Kelvin universe characters. And
I have that.
I was excited because I got to do like Green Lantern. It was like my first.
Then what a way to start out with Green
Lantern. Yeah. Freaking kind of crazy. And so I did the thing with the power ring, like creating the Enterprise. Man. And the other thing is I don't love drawing people. I'm great with ships and stuff like that, but people for me is difficult. So you'll notice that Green Lantern is more of a silhouette of a Green Lantern.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay.
But that was part of the style on top of it. I really like Art Deco.
Yeah, that's very Art Deco. I work in a building from 1930, I think, actually. And cool. You'll see a lot of those types of shapes there as well. So it's very cool. Jace?
So that's what I started there. So yeah, I guess officially I started in like 2016 with that, but shortly after was the book.
Did you have to like verify you weren't being pranked? Because Twitter is a wild place. Oh. I'd be so worried that people are like,
Well, it was... It was coming from the official account on a DM, so I kind of figured unless somebody hacked it,
back then the blue check mark meant something.
So. Yes, exactly.
Go ahead, Jay.
So I still don't call it Twitter, or I call it X. I'm
just like, it's the only time you can appropriately dead name, in my opinion.
What? I literally was just going to say this. I had somebody come at me the other day. I'm like, okay, X, the company, is not a person. It doesn't deserve that kind of respect. The person behind it doesn't deserve that kind of respect, honestly. But I'm not dead naming it. It's just like, it's a brand. I ended up blocking the person because they wouldn't let it go. Bye-bye.
Well, you know, if they suck up to Elon Musk enough, they'll get a bonus or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know
what
they're doing. So aside from Stranger Worlds, which I have and I love, where else can we find your comic book artwork?
There was the first Discovery comic that was like the Light of Kalis.
There it is. Yeah, I got it.
So this was when, you know, nobody really knew the Klingon aesthetic for them. So I kind of borrowed bits and pieces from things that I kind of thought it looked like. And then I talked with Neville Page, because he's the one who designed that, because he was a friend. And he's just like, I'm not allowed to tell you anything about it, but the direction you're going is close. And that's one of the difficult things about comic books. You often get like, here's the story. I'm like, okay, great. What scene do you want me to draw? Or what? Oh, we haven't written it yet. So you're like, that's why comic book covers sometimes don't at all match what's inside, because it's just, you get the general concept. That's why sometimes I enjoy having the issue number 4 as opposed to issue number 1, just because I get more time to get something that means something to the comic book.
Yeah, it's a precedent. Yeah. Amazing.
So, but yeah, so that was my second one. Then I worked on the Star Trek Discovery Adventures in the 32nd Century. They were four one-off stories of the characters that we didn't really spend a lot of time with.
Adira!
Adira, yes.
That was the one that had the issue about Grudge, wasn't it?
That was later on. Yeah.
Or was
that
Grudge,
later?
No, Grudge was the first one. Then it was okay. Adira.
Yeah.
Then it is.
I loved that one so much.
Yeah, I mean,
that's get my cat, to... basically. That's I yeah. kind of like, she was sitting at the window and kind of glow silhouetted by the sun and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, I have to use that concept somehow.
Yeah. I know that you didn't write it, but the comic was so great because they gave Grudge an inner monologue.
Yeah.
And there was one at one point, like Book has a holographic goldfish and Grudge tries to eat it and realizes it's a hologram. I did not allow him to look at me for a week. It was just, it's such a cat. I just love that.
It was the person who wrote it. So they actually use that cover as the cover for the trade where they put them all together at the end. So that's kind of cool. And then the next one was Detmer, and it was kind of her inner childhood. Basically, she was talking to her actual inner child, and so I got to draw this crazy kind of like Calvin and Hobbes sort of enterprise, which was a lot of fun. And I got to put flames on the back like the old comic books from Gold Key. So there was like a lot of fun to that. And I even got an article written by I don't think it was Giant Robot, but one of those blogs that you have to triple check to see if they're actually telling you the truth about anything. This is possibly the weirdest enterprise yet. Like, what are they thinking? Just like, it's like, watch the story first. Like, I don't need to know the story to know that it's wrong.
No, one of those. Jesus.
Giant freaking robot.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I don't think it was that, but it was something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I noticed about your cover arts artwork is your ships are insanely cool.
I like ships.
Yeah. Like,
I wanted that to just be this and not the ship, the
that's
person
my
in the front.
Favorite one. Like, oh my gosh.
Oh, it's so good. And then, of course, this you have an angle, you have really good angles of the ships too, because then you're getting some special, like, bottom shots. They're just amazing. This is the.
It also comes from, like, holding your Eagle Moss. Taking a picture of it.
How did that
angle.
I took my Eagle Moss and I flipped it around, and that's how you got this. You're welcome. Yeah.
And I'll do that with like people too. Like, you know, like if I want somebody to grab something
around.
But no, like, you know, like I'll hold my hand a certain way and take a picture of it just because like drawing hands is awful. I think most comic creators don't like doing that. So the more I can get like an actual reference of what it should look like, the happier I am.
So if I send you a picture of my hands, would it help?
Am I drawing your hand?
Portuguese hands, so it'd help. It could help. Such a big canvas. I have huge hands.
I actually have worked with the cover that I can't talk about yet. There's another one coming out in February. I think it's February. There's Picard's Starfleet. I did a cover for that, which is a nod to the travel posters of the 30s and 40s. Cool. So it's a Golden Gate Bridge and a shuttle flying over it and stuff like that. There it is.
Yeah.
And then there's one after that, and it's not that series, but they didn't want me to tell the series, and they definitely don't want me to tell you what's on the cover. So it's the first time I've really worked with a real spoiler, because like, I did a Picard thing with the Golden Gate Bridge on the front. Oh no, you ruined the surprise that they're in San Francisco. I think a lot of it's just, you know, covering their ass, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, our book actually got released some of the pages early, which kind of tanked some of our, we were supposed to have a article in Wired and something on E. Mm-hmm. And because the publishers wanted to get it out there early, they put it on Amazon, like all the pages that were going to go into that article. And so the article was like, nope, it's not exclusive anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This is from the Star Trek Adventures, which I was really excited about this. I got to write for the RPG supplement with the animated series. And it got to be semi-narrative, which is kind of neat. So we had Eryx was sort of the framing character, because apparently Edosians live very long. So basically had him still alive in the 24th century. And it was roughly around the time when Spock was going to Romulus to try and broker.
Red Matter. Yeah. Oh, reunification.
Before unification. It was like, yeah. I think maybe a couple months after that or something. Just basically, they were trying to do research on, you know, what other kind of societies had this problem where they've broken apart and come back together. Well, it's weird. In TAS, there's actually two of them. There's the Kzinti and the Kaitians, and there's also the Aurelians and the Skor. Well, we don't know if the Aurelians and Skor originally were supposed to be that. They are now. Mike McMahon at one point had mentioned something, and I said, no, that's a... I explained that, no, this is a Skor just by this one... They use the same character model, but they just tweaked it slightly. And he's like, well, how do you know they didn't unify? I'm like, oh, that's cool. So we basically used that as a starting point to kind of blow that out. And we also gave you a little bit of a story about the Spock 2, the giant Spock.
Yes. The one that that one.
Yes. Cool. And you will see him later in Lower Decks, and we explain how that happened.
Yeah, poor giant Spock.
Yeah. But it was fun because we got to, you know, put a little bit of, you know, there's character, like Eric said, you know, setting set, sir, and we're in orbit, and you know, like he didn't really have much dialogue, so you had to kind of infer from his the way he delivered the dialogue what, you know, we basically made kind of like a sarcastic kind of guy, so you know, just like because he was always going ooh or whatever, he, you know, he reacted to what happened on the stage or on the bridge. I got to do all the artwork that you're showing. Some of that ended up in the animated series style guide, which is another thing I got to work on this year. It's the 50th anniversary. I probably should have said that. I think because of Prodigy and Lower Decks, well, Prodigy at the time, that animation was like a bigger thing now. And so we were able to talk them into, you know, doing something with it. And it's really funny. Like TAS is really popular with a lot of people at the top. So it was easier to do that. Like even Alex Kurtzman outbid me on stuff that I was going to put into the book. And then we were supposed to get scans of those slides. They were going to take them, but he had them all professionally framed. So to take them out of all of that would have just been a nightmare. And so we're like, whatever, we'll find other things.
Oh, wow.
So, but that was funny. So the fact that
how was the bidding war? Was that on eBay or something?
It was eBay and American Heritage Auction.
Yeah. How did they, so you figured out his clue's handle, or did he like?
Oh, look, no, I didn't. Got. Somebody just told me it's like, oh, look at he got all these new things that he bid on. So somebody was like, oh yeah, that's what I was bidding.
Oh wow, that's wild.
So that was pretty funny because they know it's nostalgia and you can use it as a way to advertise Lower Decks and Prodigy in some way. So that's kind of what the direction was. And at first it wasn't going to be there wasn't as much TAS stuff, but then the writer's strike happened and then the actor's strike happened. So that was something that is animation. So it's not covered in there.
Yeah.
And it was from 1973. So we don't even have to worry about like any of the actors, a couple of them are alive, but they're, you know, it's not going to be an issue with breaking a strike line or anything like that. Cause we're never going to get any of those people to show up anyway.
Right.
So that ended up being a little bigger. And like Comic-Con, I ended up being able to design pins for.
Yes.
They were very like, so we got Kukulkan, which you did see in Lower Decks. If you saw the in the Mind's Mind,
yes.
Oh, there you go. That's better. Yep. Yeah. He was chasing after Billups, I think. So that was kind of like that was another one of those like, hi, would you want to design a pin? I'm like, sure, that'd be cool. Can you have it tomorrow morning? Just like, oh, that was insane. Because everything just changed so quickly that it was just they didn't have any notice, and it's like they had to get it out or it wouldn't have made been able to be manufactured and put into the, you know, ready in time for Comic-Con. I enjoy stuff like that because that's kind of a challenge and I like drawing that. I think if that was like my regular clients, like, oh, we need these banners for a bank, you know, by tomorrow morning, I'd be like, no. Not no, I wouldn't say that, but it's like you kind of like make them realize that this is not less than a 24-hour turnaround is really kind of rude. But I really enjoyed the 50th anniversary stuff I got to work on. So that was pretty cool. And for 3 months, I didn't have to do anything else but Star Trek. And that was made my ADHD very happy. It was something I really liked and I could do one thing.
Yeah,
it was all I did.
All right. So I got to ask you.
Yes.
Dream project you have never done before, what would it be and why?
I think it would, this is going to come off weird, but like behind the scenes creating products that go in movies and signage and basically stuff that Mike Okuda did, you know, for there's a warehouse in downtown Los Angeles that was recently featured on from Mythbusters.
Our friend, friend of the pod,
Adam Savage.
Adam Savage. Yeah, worked together. When somebody that was on our pod.
Oh, really?
That's cool. Yeah, he works for Adam Savage now.
So Adam did this tour of this place, and the place is like, it reminds me of kind of how we went through the book and we found all these things in Bob's garage. It was like, you know, just excavating. They had stuff from way back where the travel pages from Casablanca.
Yeah.
Just all these things are just like crazy history, but I love making stuff like that. Things that aren't real, like the pretend ads in a magazine or something like that. So if I could do that sort of thing for productions, that would be really cool. And for Star Trek, I would just love to do UI and like all the screens. And I actually worked on Star Trek Online when they converted from desktop to console. So I just basically redrew the LCARs to fit on the screen. Like it wasn't a lot. It wasn't like really super creative, but it was cool. And I got to meet Thomas Perrone. So
you got to meet a lot of really cool people.
Well, he was my boss essentially. So yeah.
There's a reason why you meet him. But yeah. There's somebody that wasn't your boss that you kind of made new canon for, and you got to meet. And that's of course TAS.
Yes.
Or Chekhov, and somebody. I'm assuming you gave him.
Yes.
This
Darren Moser and I, who were podcast buddies at the time, decided that, you know, we asked him to, you know, can we get an interview with you? We'll come over. We got the microphones and stuff. He's like, oh, I'd rather come to you. I'm like,
oh, wow.
Okay. That's odd. So we drove over and picked him up, came over, and then the worst rainstorm that it had years started. So when Darren took him home, he's like, just pray. It's like, don't let me kill Chekhov. And oddly enough, he had no idea where he was going, which is funny because he was the navigator on the ship. So thankfully, GPS existed.
But, wow. Yeah,
so we brought him over and we had tea and cookies and talked for it. Mostly we didn't talk about Star Trek. That was kind of the idea, that he wanted to talk about some of the other things he did. Bester on Babylon 5, like his favorite.
Yeah, I was going to say Babylon. That was cool.
The writing process with him and Gene didn't seem like it was terribly fun. I think he got tired of, like, you know, revision 75. I was like, okay, just whatever, take it and you rewrite it then. Almost. Yeah. But yeah, so that was great. So yeah, and then we decided we wanted to give, whenever we had guests, we wanted to give them a TAS version of themselves. So Dorothy Fontana has one, and Walter has one. So yeah.
That's cool.
We wanted to actually hand paint them, like really did, but we couldn't find paint that would actually stick to look right. So we just photocopied acetate things. So you could still pull them apart like it was the actual animation cell. They're just printed on the cell.
Oh, that's so cool.
Idea was to make it look as much like an animation cell as possible, just for fun.
All right. So one of the things that I loved finding out about you is you're actually go beyond the world of illustration and you go in the real realm with Star Trek. And that was very difficult to say with Star Trek, and you do improv.
Yes.
Paint. How far do those dots go? No.
Yeah. those look a little mushy up front, but they're made to look like more readable at a distance, so yeah, we wouldn't normally make them that big. That's my friend Ian Carroll. He is the co-creator of the show. We have a main show. We had a main show, The Improvised Generation. And if you know Lisa Pearl, she was the captain on the show. So that was cool. And we did a spinoff for a telethon kind of thing. And the person who raised the most money would get a show run. So we ended up raising the most money. So we actually got to put the show together. So we got like 7 or 8 episodes.
Cool.
And then COVID happened. So
we
don't know what would happen after that. There's theater stuff is always dicey and sometimes, but we actually, except for maybe one, were sold out every time, which was really cool.
Very nice.
Yeah. So the idea is that our crew is the people, it's Delta Shift, basically the people who run the ship when everybody's sleeping. And the only rule is that whatever we do, we can't wake the captain. So our missions and whatever we did, we've much lower stakes. But that kind of made them fun because they were, you know, more character driven.
Yeah. So we're not
in our second episode. We had an alcohol that reversed people's personalities, but this is literally the second episode. We barely knew what our personalities were. So, but that's very much like the Naked Now. It's like, that was not the time to have that episode either.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you know, our things, we don't save the ship. We save each other.
It was a to boldly go where no one has gone before 7 a.m.
Oh, nice. Oh,
wow. You got to work on another cross genre aside from Star Trek and DC. You got another work with another one of my favorites, and that would be Aliens. And I really like Acceptable Losses, and I love the little tagline, the crossover event. That never happened.
Well, yeah, there's a story behind that. That was
I
turned in kind of a spec cover because I knew that it was coming. They had announced it in the trades, and before it had even like gone through a whole cycle of the news or whatever, I got a like, don't tell anybody, but it's been canceled because James Cameron didn't want anything. Directed whatever was happening.
Ridley Scott didn't
want any other sci-fi franchise to be connected with Aliens. And so this really cool idea just got canned. So I did a couple concepts. And then for Alien Day, I thought, hey, why don't I just build them out? Like, see what they would look like if I'd actually drawn them. And the Woodwards, who were going to do the story, they're just like, this is amazing. It's like, we don't know what our story would be, but they just look like they would fit. There was Borg and Romulans. We knew that much. So we were going to get a Borgified alien.
Nice.
So, yeah. And I really wish that had happened because it could have been interesting, especially it would allow TNG to go a little darker than they normally would.
I was just thinking, like, how would that work? Because the aliens, they have the blood.
They have the acid blood. It would dissolve the nanoprobes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm so angry.
We actually had a we made up a reason why it didn't or how it worked. And now I don't remember.
They adapted.
I think it's the nanites would actually use the acid as a conductor or something like that. And basically the blood that was around it transformed. So it wasn't melting.
Oh man, I always been like, we use little shields. We had tiny little.
I don't know, but maybe that's it was nobody thought that far ahead because
would they come out of the walls going, I am
yeah,
you will be a Simba.
Oh man,
well, the idea that like, Borg girls, we want to be perfect or whatever, they literally seem like they're the same character or same type of creature from the moment we saw them to when they end. Like, you're not getting any more perfect. I don't know what your idea of perfection is, but so
well, just
as the alien, they always said, you know, the alien, what is it, the perfect specimen,
perfect specimen,
there's a perfect something, perfect because specimen. There's a podcast called that named after your alien. That kind of made sense, the perfection of both of those.
Yeah,
so, yeah, that was fun. That would have been a lot of cool, really cool.
Oh, what a shame that didn't happen, because Alien's been crossed with everything. I remember Superman versus Alien.
Yep.
I remember Predator Terminator Alien
versus Terminator Alien. Versus Alien.
I have my Predator versus Aliens comics. They were signed by somebody.
Little Orphan Annie versus Aliens. Yeah, Garfield versus Aliens. Calvin and Hobbes versus Aliens.
I hate being on the Alien.
Yeah. We need Moopsie versus
Aliens. Moopsie, yes! Woo!
That would have been good.
There would have the aliens would have to stand a chance, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Eat their exoskeleton. That'd be
cool. Well, yeah, if it's... how does it... he worked with the acidic nature. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, how did their bones not get dissolved?
It's like a spicy sauce to Moopsie.
You
know, Moopsie.
Yeah, that's great.
So one of these photos that you sent me, which I thought was really cool, are your co-works. And is this your office or is this?
No, this is my hallway in my apartment. But when I moved, I said, you know, it's like, if I ever had my own place where there was a place to do that, I want to recreate Peter's alternate universe comic books from Fringe, where he had like, you know, the Red Lantern and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I was going to print them out and put them in the frames. And then I had these comic books that was a 4-set. And that was I could only put 4 in that hallway. So I'm like, okay, I'll just put the Star Trek things up there. So they've been Star Trek since then, but I'm going to go get some of them printed. I've got high res versions of them and put them up there.
That's so funny. You just awoke a core memory about Peter's Red Lantern cover, and I'm just sitting there thinking, and that actually became a reality in our reality.
Yeah,
years later. That's so funny.
They did all the colors they did red.
There was blue, also a really colors. Weird, like I don't know what their how they retro canoned it or whatever, but in their universe, Super or Batman dies and doesn't come back, and he's replaced with like the Mantis or something like that.
Right.
But there are times when people know who Batman is, and there are other people who like. Batman doesn't exist. So the only thing that we could think of is that it happened so long ago for like an adult or for a kid or whatever. It's like, they're not going to know that there was something called Batman before because it's not current. It's not in any movies or whatever. It's only the Mantis. So,
wow.
That would have been interesting. But yeah, so I wanted to recreate Peter's world. I like that show a lot. I love Parallel Universe.
I need to rewatch that. I just
God. One of the old shows that we have on here did a Fringe look back, and it ended up sparking the fire to make me rewatch the entire series again.
The last year with the whole jump ahead thing, I've not ever been a fan of those, but
yeah, it becomes hard to like keep track of. And
well, so you whatever you were caring about is just seems to have been like transplanted to something else, and you have to like, yeah.
But I mean, one of the things that you took a great part of, and now it correlates because Fringe has John Noble, who was the divine
in
Star Trek Prodigy. Look how wonderful we are, Jason. We could work.
Wow. and starring alongside the great Leonard Nimoy.
Yes, that's right. Look at you.
Who was Cybok, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. He was Cybok.
I found a picture random from Comic-Con where he's in the background. I didn't even notice it before. Like he's just signing stuff in at the table. Like, hey, it's Leonard Nimoy.
That's cool.
You know, funny. I went to a comic book convention with my children for the very first time, and I was taking a picture of them in front of the DeLorean, and this guy just walks between us and looks right at me as he walks between us, and I just kind of go prick like that, and I looked, and it was Brent Spiner. And I just very quickly I tried to take another picture, and I got Brent Spiner's foot as he's leaving after I called him a prick.
Wow. Well, I guess we won't be able to have him on, but
he was lore. It was
he doesn't know it was me. I weighed 413 pounds back then. He doesn't know it was me.
Wow.
Don't really? Print this. Don't publish it.
Yes. Edit this part out. He's not going to edit it out.
It's weird. You can actually, sometimes you search for something and it finds the transcript. It'll find the part that somebody said in the video, which is like, that never happened before. That's kind of weird. My friend and I are thinking of doing a podcast, you know, like to boldly go where? Somewhere or something like some sort of clever thing where it's we start about one topic in Star Trek and eventually it has to come back to that, but it can go anywhere in between.
Well, this section, right?
Yes. All right, so Prodigy.
Yes, you were part of the group that was able to get the ball rolling on saving Star Trek Prodigy. Yeah. And I know I saw a photo on Twitter, which I wish I would have taken, and you did a great job because we got to watch it on Netflix, and that was wonderful and such a great show. And I'm currently playing the video game, so
if you're cool. You know. Yeah, that was organized by what is her name on Twitter? Mag's mom, something like that. She's in Germany. And so she did like the legwork to find out how much it would cost to hire a plane and fly it. And I'm thinking, this is not going to be affordable. Like, you know, like, yeah, we can crowdsource it and whatever. But $1,200.
Wow. Oh, man.
I have so many petty messages
Santa Monica.
I can have
overblown over people.
So you flew, so
the plane over Apple, over Santa Monica, and then somewhere else, and then it came and it finished in Hollywood over Netflix. So,
and Netflix was, picked up
pretty cool.
Yes,
but Netflix was like, they looked out the window and was like, "What's the Star Trek Prodigy? Maybe we should buy that."
Honestly, don't know if that's the funny. It's like that thing, the plane itself probably wouldn't have changed anybody's mind necessarily, but the fact that it got into Variety and into the Hollywood Reporter and stuff like that, and then people started noticing it. So I think that was we did a good job of that.
Well, that was
and Bonnie, you know, posted her because she was Bonnie, Aaron Waltke, so we were all hanging out there. So just it was Aaron Waltke. From Prodigy, but
yeah.
Oh no, Bonnie was there too. So Bonnie
Gordon. Bonnie's amazing. She's the godmother of our puppy Teddy, our little mouse.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
she's actually the reason that we did improv, or thought we could do a show, because we were all dressed up and we're with the Improvised Generation. They're like, "Oh, get in the picture." And like, "We're not part of the show." Like, "How are you not part of the show?" Oh, that was Bonnie. I'm like, so they made us, you know, we got a cast photo of a show that we were not in. And then we're like, "Well, maybe we could do this," you know, and then we started planning it and stuff like that. So wow. Her little comment was actually kind of the impetus for us to do that.
Well, look at that. Kudos to Bonnie. She's such a great person. Yeah. And we'll be hanging out with her in Trek Long Island this coming May, because it's a brand new year. So happy new year, everybody.
Woo! Woo! I've decided not to say like, "Oh, let's make this a better year," or whatever. It's like, I'm not taunting the universe. I'm not going to put any kind of pressure on it. You know, it's like,
yeah. Just make it so.
New year, new mental image, new mental difficulties. I don't know. Tuvix, was Janeway a murderer, or did Tuvix deserve it?
If I could go back in time and just take that story, it's not a bad story, but it's just like the discourse around it doesn't make Star Trek any better, and it just creates annoying memes. So it's just like, if I could just make it disappear, I would.
I saw one the other day that I thought was brilliant. It had a fan smiling, and it said, "Fans, when Benjamin Sisko has to make a moral decision with no right or wrong answer, with, you know, with subtle nuances and everything." And then it had them like angry. And the next one said, "Fans, when Janeway has to make a decision with no right or wrong answer."
If you read her biography or autobiography, which obviously is not written by her, but they talk about that decision, and it's really, you know, able to hear her internal monologue and stuff like that. It's like, "Oh, that makes a lot more sense." And this is sort of like, they were in the middle of nowhere with the, you know, they had to make up their own rules essentially. And it's like, do you get your navigator or navigator, your first officer, and he wasn't your first officer either. What is the security officer? But like her best friend and, you know, essentially before they even left, and, you know, you get them back, and Neelix, who is also very important in, you know, knowing the Alpha Quadrant and stuff like that. Yeah, or you get this combined person that isn't really both of them.
Right.
You know,
he's the worst of both worlds. You know?
Yeah. Well, I'm even wondering, it's like, were they ever separated? We don't really know their biology. They could have been two consciousnesses living in one.
Can you imagine, like, go ahead, Jace.
If Tuvix truly had Tuvok inside of him and understood Tuvok, he would know that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one, and therefore would have volunteered to allow himself to be separated.
Yeah.
However, he did not. Therefore, he was a selfish individual holding two other crewmen hostages, and he deserved his fate.
There you go. Now, you ever think, like, there's some little elements of it that still completely rubbed off on Tuvok, and then all of a sudden he's like scratching his arm. He's got like a little fur on his arm. Oh, what's this? No!
We did the little 1 foot dance at the end when Neelix left.
Yeah.
So that was something.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right. So one last thing.
That was my question, I guess.
All right. So before we wrap up, there's one last thing I want to ask you, and that is, of course, the internet sensation, the amazing meme that changed Star Trek forever. And that is Wolf359 was an inside job, changed my mind. Now, I have actually used this meme, and I called the Kazons or a Wish version of Klingons. I think that was mine.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I made that as a, you know, it was sort of like the end of that season. And it was just like, I thought it was kind of a funny parody of a meme that I really didn't know much about. And I didn't realize the political kind of leanings of the person who was in that meme. And so when I put it out, it started out like people were kind of like not happy with it, because it was like, "Why are you imitating that person? He's a kind of an asshole." Very shortly afterwards, became really popular because people said, "Oh, we can use this and we don't have to use the guy, but it's the same idea." And it kind of played off of that. So it was, I didn't know it had been used to start with. I had a couple of people tag me. It's like, "You know, these people have used your meme without, you know, permission." I kind of knew that when I went put it out, it's not gonna, you know, be mine, but I didn't like that they photoshopped off my signature and stuff like that. Was kind of annoying.
Yeah,
I had the original tweet, so I can always source it back to that. But anything I put on Twitter, I kind of realize is going to possibly not be mine anymore. I learned that really early on with Discovery. Almost all of my early Discovery fan art is, a poster or a t-shirt or a magnet or something through eBay through a Chinese company. Even the designed as like, these could might be the badges that Picard's going to wear when we did for Trek movie. They turned them into real badges. Just like, okay. So I have to admit, I did buy one because I was like, hey, somebody made it. That's cool. But yeah, that was interesting. But yeah, so that's that. The meme is, that was me.
Amazing. It's so much fun. And this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us in the Captain's Quadrant. Yes, it's always good to see you, Geek Filter. Aaron, please let everybody know. And these links will be obviously below that you can click on them and where to buy some of your work, where to support you as best they can. And of course, where they can learn more about the amazing Geek Filter himself. All your wonderful socials, so they can go and nag you for other things.
Well, my socials are at Geek Filter wherever. So it's Threads, Blue Sky, Twitter, then
Spill,
Instagram, or something. Yeah, like whatever. So you'll find it all that. Like, just put that in, you'll see me. And recently, I like last week had a clip in on StarTrek.com where they took a 2-hour interview and boiled it down to an hour or 1 minute and 30 seconds. Just like,
wow.
Thanks for making me drive across town for that. No, no, I should be. The article went with it is much more in depth. But so we basically had kind of like this, but it was just like these weird, not weird, but like, you know, random rapid fire questions that they could use to kind of create smaller pieces. And I think they're going to turn them into TikToks at some point. And
yeah,
but yeah. So you can see me talking about TAS on that. And other than that, right now we don't have any shows for improv because they're building a new theater, so that's kind of on hold right now. And well, if you have work for me, let me know. If you have any design work, last year was a little slow towards the end. I think for a lot of people.
Could folks buy your book, The Official Guide to the Animated Series, which is stellar and has so much fun
work. That's the second printing. It's the 50th anniversary. Oh. And you can tell that by, well, one, by we fixed some typos. And two, that was a whole long story. But
yeah,
our copywriter's name was misspelled.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was.
You think the copywriter would have caught that?
Yeah, I was thinking
but that we had too. Another that's the thing is, like, we had to make another revision of something and it got carried into another column and like the letter got, I don't know, it was just a mess. But it was towards the end, there was a lot of just, you know, hurrying to get it done and out the door for publishing. But I would say if you can get it at your like local comic book store or bookstore, you ask them to order it, even like that's so much the better, just because, you know, support your local stores and your local businesses. Yeah. If not, you can get them on, you get on Amazon, Target, Walmart, I think. Mm. So yeah. So anywhere you get like the big places that have, you know, standard books, you can get them there probably.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being here with us. We'll make sure to link all of those below, and thank you for giving us a listen and watching our wonderful show. And with Aaron, please be sure to like, subscribe, and ring the bell so you can be notified of all of our future episodes. And if you're listening to our podcast, please be so kind and leave us a rating, 5 if you're friendly, and if not, 5 anyway. So we will see you next time. Thank you so much. And Jason and I will be sending a quick spin of the Wheel of Agony for our next Agony booth next week when we review Star Trek 5. Aren't you excited? Star Trek, no, they bring back the joy. It's Star Trek 5. Oh,
I don't know that show.
Affirmative.